you recognize our guest, Juliette Huddy.
Juliette Huddy.
Juliette Huddy.
She's a well-known national television news anchor and personality.
I'm Juliette Huddy. You may know me from television. Professionally, I always felt a little restrained. The thing is, I'm anything but conservative, as you would expect someone who works at Fox News to be. I've been married a few times. My husband's a rocker. We don't have kids. All the money that we save on not having kids, we spend on travel, and I've met so many incredible people along the way. They're provocative, controversial, brilliant, and you'll meet them all. Get ready to experience things you've never experienced, never expected either, on Juliet Unexpected. My next guest, honestly, where do I even begin? Michael Alago is his name. He has achieved so many incredible things while at the same time battling some demons and a closed-minded society, I have to say. He's the focus of a Netflix documentary. It's called Who the F Is That Guy? The Fabulous Journey of Michael Alago. And it follows the incredible, fabulous career of this gay Puerto Rican New Yorker's rise through the ranks of the rock music scene here in New York while also dealing with drug addiction and eventually HIV. I actually met Michael at an art expo featuring my friend Vincent Castiglia. He's that brilliant, controversial artist who paints in his own blood. Well, anyway, Alago and I unexpectedly hit it off, and the rest is history. Oh, and did I mention? He also signed Metallica. Welcome, Mr. Michael Anthony Alago.
Thank you.
Good to see you.
Thanks.
I want to just, you know, I guess the reason that I stumbled upon you was because we have a mutual friend.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought you were just such a wonderful, big personality. And then I come to find out that, oh my God, this guy is sort of an icon in the music industry. And let's just get to, you know, cut to the chase. You signed Metallica.
Yep.
And I
Summer
know
of 1984.
You've told this story a million times, but and because I want to talk a little bit more about just
sure.
you as opposed to just your in, you know, you in the music industry, but just give us a real quick nutshell of how that sort of came about. I mean, you're this young guy from New York, gay guy in an industry, especially in the rock and metal world, that mm-hmm. that would be sort of, I guess, an anomaly, mm-hmm. at least somebody who was out.
Well, you know, I think I came out of the womb loving music, and I always knew I wanted to do something in the music business, but mm-hmm. I had no idea what that meant. What does that mean to a 14-year-old kid from Brooklyn? I have no idea. So I watch all the music channels on TV. I hear wildly diverse music from R&B to hard rock to top 40 pop, mm-hmm. and that informs my early listening. One day I was working in the East Village on Astor Place. I was walking down the block and I saw a sign on a building that said video club opening, and I thought, I'm going in there. I went in, I looked around. It was what was then known as Webster Hall, soon to be called the Ritz.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a beautiful Art Deco building. And I walked in and there was a gentleman in the balcony, and it felt like the Wizard of Oz. And he said, kid, we're not open. What can I do for you? I said, well, I want a job. And he said, do you have a resume? I said, I don't have no resume. And he laughed. And he said, come up to my office. And his name is Jerry Brandt. And he's an incredible entrepreneur. He ran the Electric Circus in the 60s on St. Mark's Place. He's revolutionary. Mm-hmm. You know, he discovered Carly Simon, the Voices of East Harlem. He helped bring the Rolling Stones here to the United States.
So this guy becomes your mentor.
He is my mentor. He likes that I know a lot about different kinds of music. And he said, I'm going to hire you. You're going to get my mail. You're going to get my lunch. You're going to answer my phones.
Now, what was it? Now, what made you want to do that? Because I know a lot of, you know, these days. Well, to just be able to be just be a gopher as opposed to, like, I know a lot of kids that go into something like this and they go.
I was 19.
They wanted to be given to you everything on a plate.
No. I have always been a hard worker,
mm-hmm.
and when this gentleman, who I later find out who he really is, offered me a job, I felt like I'm in the music business.
Yeah.
And so all that stuff I didn't mind doing because I listened to all his phone calls when he talked to agents on the phone on how to book a 1,500-seat room. And I was learning. I was like a sponge. I wanted to absorb everything. I wanted to know all about the music business. And it was like on-the-job training. Mm-hmm. And so I did that for about 3 years. But in that 3 years, I also started to book the room. I spoke to agents on the telephone, and I was very clear about cutting deals. And that was the start of it all when I was 19 years old. And so about 3 years after that, I was getting a little restless. And my friend Mitchell Krasnow said to me that his dad, Bob Krasnow, was going back to, he was leaving Warner Brothers and going to Elektra Records. And he was going to Elektra Records to like revamp it because it was in the crapper. Mm-hmm. So I told Jerry that, you know, I'm going to look for a new job. And I think I could get this interview with Bob at Elektra. So Jerry said, I don't want to lose you, but I'll call Bob as well, because I know Bob for years. And Bob's son, Mitchell, told his father about me. So Bob was hearing about me from two different avenues. I had this interview with Bob Krasnow, and it was the same interview that I had with Jerry Brandt about music. But Bob also loved art, so there was all this great art on his wall, 80s art, Robert Longo, Keith Haring. And so that was another thing we spoke about. He said he would call me in 2 weeks. He called me in 2 weeks, and I got an A&R job. I had no idea what to do as an A&R executive.
What is an A&R executive exactly?
A&R is artist in repertoire. Mm-hmm. You are in a department that signs artists and develops them. What that meant to me was looking for greatness.
What at that time, mm-hmm. and what year are we talking about at this point?
I started Elektra Records late 1983.
What at the time for you was a sign of greatness in an artist or a band?
Mm-hmm. I think somebody who is wildly charismatic, someone who on stage knows how to relate to an audience, someone who writes great songs that perhaps have universal appeal.
Do you have to have a great voice?
That's subjective, great voice. Mm. You know, you can have a little teeny tiny voice that people relate to it because of that smallness, but you know how to get the point across. Mm-hmm. And maybe you're telling a good tale. So, you know, a voice is all subjective. It's also like, does Tom Araya from Slayer have a good voice?
Right.
He screams his head off.
Or Gwen Stefani. I mean, you hear her voice initially. I remember I saw them at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Mm-hmm. They're playing at some fraternity party 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I remember being like, she's so cute and hot, but that voice is like a nightmare. Of course, I mean, it's her
moneymaker.
But I
also want to clarify, you know, for some reason, Tom Araya is the first person that came into my head. And I love Slayer. I saw them 3 times on this last farewell tour. And, you know, they're so brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, they're Slayer.
They're one of a kind.
One of a kind is right.
Same thing, Metallica. One of a kind.
What was it mm-hmm. when you saw Metallica? Mm-hmm. These are young guys at this point.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you're also seeing a lot of other bands that are out there, really good bands. What was it that made you just go, holy shit, this is...
Well, you know, I'm out every night as an A&R person.
Yeah.
I'm also meeting with unsigned bands, lawyers, and managers in my office every day. I don't know. In 24 years, I have listened to thousands mm-hmm. upon thousands of demo tapes.
So that makes it easy for you to just pluck one out and say, I know this one stands out?
Well, it's not that easy, but, you know, over those years, I've heard lots of good stuff. Mm-hmm. Lots of good stuff. But good ain't great. And if you thought you were going to sign everybody good, you just can't afford to do that.
Right.
So to answer your question, I saw Metallica a couple times before I signed them. I saw them at L'Amour in Brooklyn in 82. I saw them at the Stone in San Francisco in 83. I was friends who became a close colleague of mine, Johnny Z, at Megaforce Records, had a small independent label. And he said, you know, I want to send you the records we're putting out. So they were the first Metallica record. Mm. It was also Anthrax. And he may have made a Raven record. Well, when I heard Metallica on vinyl, after I saw them those 2 times, I thought, these people are special. They are not doing traditional hard rock, heavy metal. They were combining all elements of punk and speed and British heavy metal, American hard rock and metal, into this one thing that they call Metallica. And any time that I, those 2 times that I saw them prior to seeing them summer of 84 at Roseland, where I actually signed them, I thought, these are people who are young and crazy and drink a lot, and they are so focused that it's unbelievable. And never mind that James Hetfield has always been a wildly charismatic person on stage. And you felt that the minute you walked in the room, saw him on stage, and he knew how to whip a crowd into a frenzy. And I thought, wow, these are people I want in my life.
And that was a fateful fateful decision that you made.
Absolutely. Well, because I was talking to Johnny Z about Raven, and I gave Raven demo money because John thought, well, they're going to be so huge, Raven, and I just can't do it. I can't do what I need to do with them on an independent label. The demos that they sent me were fabulous. It just wasn't my thing once I heard Metallica. Like, all bets were off with everybody. So I saw them at Roseland, August of 84. I ran backstage, a little drunk, and, you know, hugging and kissing everybody. And they thought, this is an A&R person. And they took me seriously. The next day, they were in my office in the conference room. We had beer and Chinese food. I gave them cassettes and vinyl. And, you know, it just feels like they never left the office, and the rest is history, as we know. That signing helped change the face of hard rock and heavy metal.
It 100% did.
Absolutely.
I mean, and they still, I mean,
35 years later.
Yep.
35 years later, they put out that last record, Hardwired to Self-Destruct.
Yes.
It's very true to form. It feels like a lot of things from back in the day, from previous records, and they're still playing 30,000 seat stadiums.
Yeah, I mean,
that's a blessing.
It really is.
And that says it's a testament to how great someone is.
It really is. One of the things that I find so fascinating, though, is that now I always try to sort of pinpoint where did the industry go wrong? because there are a lot of, you know, is it social media? Is it just people got, you know, bored with rock, or, you know, more into hip hop? What do you look at when you look at the music industry now? How does it compare to when you were, you know, back there discovering bands, and who stands out now?
Well, let's see. I did A&R from 1983 to 2005. That's about 24 years there. And then there was a thing called artist development, that if you signed an act and perhaps their first record did about 50,000 units, you would wonder, so now we're in the 80s, was that getting played on Headbangers Ball? Did they sell those 50,000 because the record company gave them tour support to go on the road for a year? And you'd monitor all that. And if you really were dedicated to this band and they only sold that 50,000, you would say, one would say, let's make another record. Fast forward, that's a loaded question. Where did it go wrong, or why don't people buy records? I don't know why people don't buy records anymore. But, you know, everything is moving over to streaming now.
But I also have noticed that, you know, the amount of clubs out there where you see live music, I mean, they've really just kind of dissipated.
Yeah.
And
not
people
like
don't seem to like to go to watch live music that much.
Mm. Well, I don't know. I always find that I still like going to
live
music.
I love going to it.
So, because we live in New York, you know, we could go to, where can we go? We can go to St. Vitus
Saint
in
Vitus,
Brooklyn,
yes.
Which I love
Black
that Thorn. Place. I'm going to go there September 18th to see Phil Anselmo and the Illegals.
Very nice.
So, yeah, there's Blackthorn. There are places here and there.
Dingbats?
Nothing like it was, yes, in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. Nothing like it was back in the day. I can't really explain it, though. I still want to hold a CD in my hand.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But you could still, there are still so many amazing bands out there. I almost feel like people from our generation don't really know that there are still new rock bands that are coming out right now that are actually really fantastic. I mean, you know, Greta Van Fleet, you know.
Yeah,
I mean, there's some really, really hot bands right now that have that sort of old rock sound.
Yep.
It's not just a lot of this sort of, what I feel like is sort of the cliched stuff that everybody sounds the same. And sometimes when I listen to Octane or, you know, some of these serious channels, I'm like, I can't tell the difference. They all sound, they have that kind of whiny type of thing going on.
I always loved those bands that are screaming and hollering and carrying on and doom and gloom, my favorite thing, doom and gloom. So, you know, I'm listening to things right now like there's a record that came out in 2009 by a British group called Gallows. And this record is called Grey Britain. It is so punk rock.
Really?
It is so hardcore. It is so fantastic that even though it's, you know, 10 years old, mm-hmm. it sounds like it was made yesterday.
I have friends and bands over in England, mm-hmm. over in Europe, and a lot of them talk about how, and some of them are newish bands, but they talk about, you know, they're touring over there, but they coming to the United States is a whole different beast because of the visas and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, we'll have people who are going to be listening to this podcast who are friends from over, you know, overseas. What are they supposed to do? It's, you know, because it's there's all this, again, visa nonsense that they have to deal with. How do you become known over here?
Well, I think if you have a good booking agent and the booking agent knows where to place you, even if the place only holds, say, 200 people, you go. Because you got to, you know, if that's what you're doing with your life, you just have to do it no matter what.
Yeah.
You know?
It's easier for younger people to do that. It's a little bit more difficult as you start to get older.
Who don't want to live in a van, small van.
Yeah, and people who have families and stuff
That's correct.
I mean, it's just, you know, you just don't make the money that you used to make in this industry. How are you making money? You're touring and merch, basically.
Touring, merch, and, you know, when you get back home, whether it's to the UK or to Germany or France or Australia, you probably have a day job.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know what? That's just the way it is right now. But if you're still totally dedicated to your craft, you're just going to do it no matter what.
You can't not do it because you'd be miserable if you didn't.
Correct. And you know who's making... I'm just a little side point. Who's making the best music of his life right now is Al Jorgensen from Ministry.
Mm-hmm.
Ministry put out a record a couple months ago called Americant. And the cant part is KKK, mm-hmm. Americant. And it's very political, and it's very right now. And, you know, he's one of those guys who's been an innovator for the last 30 years. And like I said, this is the best record of his career.
What do you think it is? Are you a fan of musicians who get political, or if for somebody who has been on the side where you're like, look, we've got to make you money, so mm-hmm. you can't alienate half your audience. You know, if you're a big Trump supporter, you might piss off half of your audience that's going to your show. Or are you like, be as provocative and crazy as you want and fuck everybody?
Well, I think one should be provocative because in that, I'm sure you're saying something. So you never want to I never want to stifle an artist. And if I love them for what they are talking about, then I'm ready to promote them. But I don't think everybody is political. But if you're smart and you really are, you know what you're talking about, and the music itself rocks, I want to hear it.
I want to hear some memories that you've had over the course of all these years that you've been in the industry that, mm-hmm. you know, people that you've come across that we might be surprised to hear that they really had an effect on your life. Is there somebody that you can just say right now, this person really got to me, whether it was just somebody that you saw perform or somebody that you got to be friends with,
mm-hmm.
whether they're famous or not famous, mm-hmm. and why?
Well, I think there are probably two people. John Lydon, formerly of the Sex Pistols and Public Image Limited, and Nina Simone. John Lydon, because when Nevermind the Bollocks came out, the Sex Pistols album, it was revolutionary. It changed the face of rock and roll here and abroad. So when I got to meet him, because I was booking the Ritz and I did a show with him with Public Image Limited, that was a total disaster. Everyone knows it. Because it was, we had Bow Wow Wow in for the weekend.
Oh, yes.
And Malcolm McLaren called me and said, "We're not coming." I'm like, "What do you mean you're not coming? I've already sent you a 50% deposit." And he said, "Well, you know, Annabella is underage and her mom doesn't want her to go overseas." I said, "Well, now you're telling me that?" I said, "What's her mom's name? I will buy her a ticket and whatever they need, please." Because both nights are completely sold out. He said, "Well, you know, we're not coming."
Oh.
So I panicked. I had to tell my boss this at some point. But I don't remember how I found out that Public Image won a press junket for Flowers of Romance. They were at Liz Rosenberg's office at Warner Brothers. And I thought, oh, I better pray to God for this one. I didn't know John then. But, you know, I've never had fear calling people out of the blue.
Yeah, I can see that.
Ever. You know, I call, this is Michael Alago. If I have to explain myself, I explain myself.
You're a salesperson.
Well, I knew how to market myself and sell myself. And I, you know, just speak the truth and whatever my needs were at that point in time. So I got on the phone with everyone. It was like a conference call. They were doing this junket. And I said, you have to pull me. I know we don't know each other, but I love Pill. I love the Pistols. And you have to pull me out of this dilemma. And, you know, they didn't have to do it. So I said, well, you know, when you're done for the day, I'll send a car. Please come down to the Ritz. I explained to them what was going on. And it all happened within 24 hours. I think I had to call Larry the Duck at WLIR in Long Island. And I said, you know what? Here's a bunch of tickets. Promote the show on the air. So within that 24 hours, I think we got Keith Levine a synthesizer so that he could program about 45 minutes of music into that keyboard. And they said, well, we really don't know what we're going to do, but we love that like 25-foot screen that you have. And perhaps we'll do something that incorporates the screen. Well, they certainly did. They came out. There were all these beautiful white lights shining on the screen, so all you ever saw were black dancing silhouettes. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, John started taunting the audience, saying, we're never coming out from behind the screen. Ha, ha, ha. And about 15, 18 minutes in, after all that taunting, the audience went berserk.
Oh, God.
You know, they wanted to really see Johnny Rotten. Mm-hmm. They were not prepared for an art event.
Right.
And that's what it was. So what wound up happening were from the balcony, chairs, bottles, tables started getting thrown to the stage. That 25-foot screen was starting to get ripped down by the audience.
Boy.
And we had to close down the club. But I thought it was fabulous. I went backstage to talk to John. That was our first time meeting. And we were nervous. We were laughing. We drank a lot. And after that, we have just been in each other's lives for 37 years. You know, at some point when I was at Elektra in 1985, I helped sign him to Elektra, and he made an album called Album. It was a generic record that Bill Laswell produced. You know, the cassette was called Cassette, the poster said Poster, etc., etc.
The T-shirt say T-shirt.
Exactly. Brilliant record. It did okay. Not the business that we wanted it to do, but it was prestigious to have someone like John Lydon on the label. Mm-hmm. The following year, I had to drop him because it would have been too expensive to keep that deal. And they didn't really want to, I think, wanted to negotiate a new deal. John laughs about it these days and says, you dropped me because all you care about is Metallica, which is not true. But, you know, in these 37 years, we've never had a bad word with each other. That's like kind of brilliant.
That
when
is
people think
unusual,
really,
too.
It's unusual. You know, John is infamous for
being difficult, bad boy,
and walking out of interviews. But he walks out of those interviews when people all they want to do is ask him ridiculous questions about the Sex Pistols. It's like so much has happened since then. Don't you want to talk about Hill? Don't you want to talk about the new release? Don't you want to talk about my two books that I put out? You know, so it gets crazy. But, you know, I'm going to go see John again this year. And he always winds up playing on my birthday, October 13th. And I think Pill are going to be at Brooklyn Steel this year. And I'm always filled with joy when I see him. He's sarcastic. He is brilliant. He is funny. And, you know, when he's in the room with a group of people, he could be the smartest person in the room. Fantastic. You know, I've had escapades and great times with lots of artists.
You mentioned Nina Simone.
Well, Nina Simone, oh boy. This could go on for hours.
Well, just what was it about? The relationship that you had,
Well, my Aunt Jenny used to play her records when I was a preteen, and I would go to my aunt's house every Saturday, and because she always listened to interesting music, mm-hmm. and I thought Nina Simone sounded interesting to me at that time. So as a grown-up, I bought a lot of her records on vinyl, and she just wound up becoming a favorite because the tone of her voice just spoke to me. I'd never heard a voice like that before. It almost had androgynous qualities to it. And
did you become friends with her?
Oh, yes.
does that mean?
Oh, fabulous. No, really fabulous. When I had the opportunity to sign her, because she had been label-less for 10 years, people spoke about her and like, she's washed up, she's troubled, why bother? And none of that bothered me, because for me, when you heard that voice, nothing mattered. And you know, she took songs from Bob Dylan and George Harrison and Jacques Brel and numerous artists, and when she sang their songs, you thought she wrote those songs, because this was a person, excuse me, who knew how to get to the heart of the matter of a song. Mm. So when it came out of her, it was totally beautiful and totally unique. And for me, it was the most glorious sound in the whole world.
Isn't it funny that there's just certain things, certain musicians that just get to you. You can't
like
explain it, or maybe you can explain it. And for me, it's a British band, Enter Shikari. When I saw them,
that's nothing.
I'm obsessed with them.
New like band? Almost,
they're not really that new. They're, you know, mid-2000s, but they're really starting to get big now. They just won Kerrang's album of the year. They are...
You're going to have to turn me on to that record,
oh, my God,
please.
I love them. Yeah, they're fantastic. But it's funny because, for me, it's the lyrics. I love the music, but the lyrics that the lead singer, Rao Rauten, writes.
And what's the name of the new album?
The new album is called The Spark.
Okay, great.
I'll send you all the info, you know, it's funny because if they listen to this, they're going to be like, Jesus, she's... Does that? I'm like their biggest PR person over here.
Why not?
But it's just there's
because that's what we do when we love music.
Yes,
we support people
absolutely. And they're, you know, the lyrics are fantastic, but their live show is really they are the best live show, best live band, Kerrang magazine. They're fantastic. But it's, you know, I could just listen to them and I cry. I mean, my husband and I are going to Paris at the end of March because they're playing the Bataclan, and I was like, I want to see Enter Shikari at the friggin' Bataclan. I mean, can you imagine?
Wow.
Yeah, it's
how exciting.
Intense. But, you
take
know,
lots of pictures.
Oh, God, are you kidding me? I'm going to be, I'm probably going to put my phone down because I want to immerse myself in every single and soak everything up. But has there been anybody or a band or an artist that you passed on that,
you know,
how
the
you're
funny
like,
story. People
Jesus.
Ask me that all the time. When I've passed on people, it's usually because I'm just not feeling it. Mm-hmm. Even when people, other A&R people or lawyers,
that you
or
regret
managers,
passing on.
I don't regret anything because you can't have everybody in your life. And when you pass on someone, it's because, well, for me, I know other A&R people don't think this way, but I only signed things that really spoke to me.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be dangerous when you work for a major corporation because sometimes my intense taste is not for the masses.
Mm-hmm.
But when I followed my heart and my gut, whether it's John Lydon, whether it's Metal Church, whether it's Michael Feinstein, whether I got to A&R, the first Tracy Chapman record.
Oh, God.
I just found that I really just wanted to be dedicated to what I was doing and only sign things that I love so that there was no regret.
Authentic.
Things that were authentic.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Things that were truly authentic.
Mm-hmm.
But what was your question?
I totally forgot it.
Okay,
I mean,
fine.
You know, we're over the age of 40. That happens.
Hello.
When I first met you, I just thought, oh, he's so great. I want to go out to lunch with him. He's fun to be around. He's interesting. And, but I guess my impression of you is you've got so many friends that, you know, it's like, oh, God, I mean, I don't know. He's probably really busy. What's your life like now? What do you do during the days? Besides, you know, you're the subject of a Netflix documentary. Now you apparently have a book deal in the works.
Sure.
What's your daily life?
I wake up. I make my bed.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, of
course.
You're
a neat freak?
No.
No,
my house is filled with clutter, and that clutter is vinyl
well,
and tons of books. But I just love the idea of making my bed every morning. I like it neat. That part, I like neat and clean.
I don't understand that, because if you, particularly when you live alone,
yeah.
For me, I was like, well, nobody's going to see. I know that I was there in the morning, and that just by making it like straight doesn't mean
it's part of my routine.
Okay.
I wake up, I make the bed, I say my prayers, and my prayers every morning is a series of thank yous, like thank you, God, for waking me up, thank you for waking me up sober, thank you for the renewed relationship with my sister Cheryl, and that list goes on until I'm tired. And then I feed the cat, and then I shower, and I walk over to my 12-step meeting, which I've been doing for 11 years now. When I get back from the 12-step meeting, which is usually at around 10:30, I start FaceTiming with my co-writer, Laura Davis. She is my co-writer on a book that's going to be coming out hopefully sometime next summer of 2019. And I got this book deal with Backbeat Books all because of a documentary that Drew Stone made about me. Mm-hmm. It was produced by Michael Alex, directed by Drew Stone. It's called Who the Fuck Is That Guy? The Fabulous Journey of Michael Alago. And it's been doing incredibly well on Netflix.
Yes.
I mean, I hear every day from people all over the world. And it's a testament to what a good job, great job Drew and Michael did, because we didn't just talk about music. It's about a life, and my life was crazy.
And you were very, very honest and open with all of the ups and the downs of your life.
If you're not honest, then where do you go from there? So yes, of course.
It seems like such an easy thing, you know, a very normal thing to say, but it's amazing how many people cannot be honest with themselves and just, you know, are afraid of being authentic.
Well, you know, I don't know where this came from, but I never had fear about saying who I am. So during the course of that 88 minutes in the documentary, you know, we talk about my 24 years as an A&R person. We talk about my drug and alcohol addiction. We also very seriously talk about sobriety, which is very, very important to me, because if I wasn't sober, I probably wouldn't be here with you today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people call me all the time and ask about, like, how did I stay sober? But just getting back to my day, I just spaced out.
Well,
so, oh yeah, so that's what I do every day. So now I FaceTime with Laura, and she's my co-writer, and I'm spitting everything out.
How is the book going to be different from the documentary?
Yeah, well, in the book, we're just going to really delve deep into a lot of things that we didn't delve deep into in the film, because mm-hmm. the film is 88 minutes. It has to have a beginning, a middle,
right,
and
right,
an end,
right,
and an arc, and you just can't tell everything. But maybe in 250 pages, there's going to be great stories about me making Cyndi Lauper's Memphis Blues record, and you would never guess how the civil rights movement enters in there, but it does. So, you know, there was a time the great Bill Graham picked me up at an airport and brought me to Jacksonville to an empty mall to see a band that he managed. I'm going to leave it at that.
Wait, what year was this? What year was this?
In the early 90s. 1990s.
Was it Limp Bizkit?
Oh, gosh, no. No.
Because I was reporting in Jacksonville in the...
Oh, how fun.
Mid-1995.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I saw Limp Bizkit. This is before they hit it big. It's a milk bar, I think it was called.
Oh, my gosh.
And then a few years later, I'm like, wait, that band? I thought they sucked.
But there are stories like that.
Yeah.
That are going to be in the book.
Oh, you can't tell me who it is?
Oh, but then it just defeats
the purpose. Okay, you can whisper it to me afterwards.
Okay. So there are stories like that, you know, and then at some point I acquired HIV, and I was asymptomatic. I was fine for a very long time until I wasn't fine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think the drinking and the crack helped.
Probably not.
Hello.
That's usually not good for anybody's immune system.
No, of course not. So at one point in time in the, 92, 93, I had full-blown AIDS, and I thought I was going to die, because all the men around me in the music business, outside of the music business, people I just knew from the neighborhood, everyone really literally was dying.
Ugh.
I was blessed with a great doctor who was on the forefront of medicine. She was in the laboratories. And when I was sick, there was just one drug out called AZT.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, Michael, don't take this medicine. I know you're feeling desperate, but I promise you there's going to be something soon. So what we later found out was AZT, if you didn't give them enough, nothing happened. If you gave people what you thought the dosage should be, it killed them. So at one point, Barbara, who was making the rounds at St. Vincent's Hospital in the AIDS ward every day, but at 5 in the morning, She would bicycle to my home when she had hundreds of other men and women to deal with.
You were that weak?
I couldn't get up for like 10 months.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
I lost tons of weight. Everybody came to my house. My friend Carol, my friend Diane, my friend Tim, my friend
Eric. To say goodbye?
Kind of. I mean, they wouldn't say that.
Right. But
yes.
You knew.
Yes. Oh, I was a mess. And that was a death sentence then in the 80s and 90s.
God, no wonder you have such an amazing attitude.
Well,
that's you almost said goodbye to the world.
She came to me one day and I forget what the antiviral was called, the protease inhibitor. She gave it to me. She said, I'm going to give you two other things, and they're not FDA approved. Mm-hmm. I said, Barbara, I'm going to do whatever you tell me. And about 9 or 10 months later, I was up. I was back at work at Elektra. I was skinny. You know, and people talk, but you know what Michael has, blah, blah, blah. I didn't give a shit. I was up on my 2 feet. And, of course, one always will have HIV, but I have never gotten sick again.
Really?
Like that.
Now you're a very fit guy.
And I also, it's an illusion. It's a loose T-shirt.
Oh, please.
For a long time.
I can feel those arms.
No. I had a trainer for 2 years, and then I got sick and tired of the gym. So now I think I'm gonna go back again soon.
Oh yeah.
But in any event, I never got sick like that again. My viral load is zero, which is like almost, it's a non-detectable thing. That's a blessing.
That's incredible.
Coming from where I came from. So I don't drink, I don't drug. October 21st will be 11 years, and it's a blessing because I show up for life. My birthday, I'll be 59, is October 13th.
So you're a Libra.
I'm a Libra.
I'm a Libra too.
When's your birthday?
September 27th.
Oh.
Yeah.
And my cousin Lisa is September 26th, and yeah. Nice.
Oh, I'm not really a horoscope person. I just say, oh, you're
a
Libra.
Oh, I love it, though. I love it.
I just like the fact that we're close
together. I
little
things. Yeah. But, just one last thing is, a testament. I was starting to tell you about how good the documentary is because Drew and Michael did a great job.
Yes, they did.
I get messages from people every day like, dude, you signed Metallica. It changed my life. Mm-hmm. To, hi, Michael. I live in Colombia with my family. I'm 21. I'm HIV positive. And if I ever told my dad, I think he would murder me. So, you can't just write back to somebody and go, yeah, dude, great or whatever. The people who are just talking about music, it's usually a simple thank you mm-hmm. I send to them and a picture of me in like Hetfield or somebody. But people who have come to me troubled like that or filled with fear because they can't be their authentic self in certain places that they live in the country. I write them back very heartfelt letters and words of wisdom and positivity that, you can do it.
That's interesting that it's like you've sort of become, an idol to a lot of these people and a leader.
Person who tells the truth.
Well,
when they know that you tell the truth and that they perhaps can trust you, that's a blessing. It's a miracle. And I'm grateful that I have that quality about me, that people do trust me.
Yes.
Nice.
Do you, you said you don't have any regrets, but I often feel like, okay, we say that, but deep down there's got to be something that we just go. I mean, I know that we can't, look, I could say I regret that I got married 3 times before I met my current husband, who I love to death and will always be together. But the fact is, it's like, I wish I could have understood life a little bit more, appreciated certain things a little bit
more. Well, sure, I can give you one very important regret. I wish that I was closer to my dad. I was at the height of my drinking and drugging when he passed. I was 32 years old, and I stole from him. And I lied to him. I said I needed money for, I don't know, to pay the rent. But I used it for cash advances, and I bought drugs.
Mm. And did he know?
No, he died 3 days later.
Oh, God, Michael.
So there I am living with, I can't even tell my dad what I was doing. So that year, I went to rehab for 30 days. When I came back home, I thought, I have to make this right. I cut up the credit cards, and I wrote him a letter, and I went to the cemetery, and I buried the letter there, and that was the best that I can do to say, I'm so sorry for what I did. So that is, I guess, a regret.
But you were, you weren't of sound mind.
I understand, but it doesn't mean that I don't have that.
Yeah.
And that I wish that over the years I paid more attention to him and our relationship.
Yeah.
I can't even find a picture of us together when I was an adult. It's so weird.
Oy.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, on the other end of the spectrum, my mom died last February, and by then I was 10 years sober, and my sister and I were at the hospital with her for the last 3 days of her life. And, you know, when you do something that's so beautiful and bittersweet and be there with the person that you love, it's my mother, there's no regret. I mean, the sadness, and I still wish I could call her every day at 10:30 in the morning like I used to call her. But, you know, I made these little funny videos of us, and she was a riot. So I have about 10 clips of us that are laugh out loud. And for me, that wound up being important because I will never forget what the sound of her voice was. And I love that. So, you know, I've come a long way since drinking and drugging. And my life, as they say in these 12-step programs, can be beyond your wildest dreams. And it is. I'm alive. I'm healthy. There's a film out about me. I'm working on a book. I'm trying to work on my fourth photography book right now.
That's the other thing I want to talk with you about. Oh, Michael, I love the photos that you take.
Oh, good.
I mean, you find specimens.
Male specimens. That is correct.
And you get them to take their shirts off.
Yes.
And they are, you know, but these are guys with amazing body. Now, what, one of our mutual friends, Rob Yules.
Oh.
Sweet Rob.
I love
him. He's a little dream boy. He's a sweet.
He's a dreamboat.
Yes, he truly is. He's a
Rob Yules, do you hear how we're speaking
about you, Rob.
On the radio?
But I mean, he's one of these guys. Yeah. You photograph him, and you know these guys are like these huge buff guys.
He's a beast.
What's give me a little bit of the scoop behind all that? Well, besides the fact that they're attractive men. Why you decided to shoot guys with their shirts off.
Well, honey, sometimes they have their pants off, too. Depends on the location. When I stopped doing A&R after 24 years, I knew I wanted to do something different. I always loved photography. I always loved looking at photo albums. I always wanted to figure out what stories these pictures were telling. So I thought, well, who am I going to photograph? And people go, oh, you should just photograph rock bands. And I was like, I'm not photographing rock bands.
Why not?
It just didn't appeal to me because after 24 years, I had enough of the music business.
Yeah.
So it would almost be like going backwards a little bit.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, what do you love more than anything? Men. And what kind of men do you love? Big, strapping, tattooed, scarred men. And I found that, you know what? I got people to say yes to me in regards to letting me take their picture. And my pictures are not glossy. They're very simple. But I feel like when I do my job in getting that picture of you and you do your job in giving me something, there's a feeling there. And the picture works.
Now, but you're taking pictures. It's not just people that you're friends with. I mean, these are people that you'll be on the street.
I walk up to people and I give them the whole Michael Alago story and they become fascinated. I think they don't know what to say. So they say yes. And, you know, we make a plan and we take a picture. And yes, the pictures are sometimes X-rated and sometimes they're just very sexy and provocative. And I have three books out. One's just called Rough Gods. One's called Brutal Truth. And the last one is called Beautiful Imperfections.
Where do we find these books?
A lot of them are out of print, but you can look on Amazon and hope that they're not hundreds of dollars.
I guess we need you to start shooting some more.
I am shooting some more, but you know, the funny part is it almost has nothing to do with those first three books because I put my cameras to the side. I'm only shooting with the iPhone with an application called Hipstamatic. I want everything to be black and white. Mm-hmm. I want it to be atmospheric. So I've been going to concerts and shooting musicians, and I try to get these portraits done in 15 minutes. And because, you know, we all just don't have time to think about it. So people are just... I don't know. When you don't have time to think about it, you're wondering, like, what's happening here?
Yeah.
And I tell people, do what I tell you, and nobody gets hurt. And, you know, so there's a little laugh going on there. But, yeah, I've gone backstage at Slayer, and there was a woman I met back there. Her name is Chris. She's from Houston. And half her face is so beautifully tattooed by Paul Booth that It's, she's magic. So I took 12 pictures of her. Three of them are gorgeous. So that's in my portfolio. I shot Venom Inc. right before they were going on stage. It's a classic black and white of them. I shoot Doyle from the Misfits all the time because I love my angel, Doyle. So I've been just shooting a lot of backstage stuff. Very interesting black and whites. I shot.
And backstage stuff is actually very cool. That's something where, you know, a professional photographer would like that sort of, you know, dark grays and blacks kind of
very
vibe.
Gritty.
Yeah,
I find rooms with walls that look like they're destroyed. Yeah. I like my backgrounds to have a bit of atmosphere. Mm-hmm. So this book, more than anything, there are men, just men that I know in the book. There'll be no X-rated nudity probably in this book. But everybody's got to have their shirt off if they're built right.
I mean, why not, for God's sake?
That's the point.
I completely encourage that. They
do this for a reason. They want to be noticed. And you know what? I'm taking notice.
You're noticing.
And I'm like, take that t-shirt off right now because we're snapping a photograph.
When are we going to see the book come out? You said next summer.
Well, you know what? Since we're speaking on the air, mm-hmm. I don't have a publisher, believe it or not. My old publisher in Berlin went out of business. So I'm looking for a publisher for this black and white portrait book that has this incredible rock and roll feel to it.
Okay. All right, so we've put the call out. Somebody will listen to this.
Thank you.
Final thing I'm not sure who the audience is going to be that's going to be listening to this. I mean, I hope mm-hmm. it's going to appeal to a wild audience.
Oh, I hope
so. The point of this is it's all these interesting, fantastical people that come into my life over the course of my, you know, I hate this expression, but my journey through life. But I definitely think that there will be a lot of musicians, you know, aspiring musicians that are going to be listening to this. If there's any sort of one little nugget of advice that you can give them based on your experience back then, based on your experience over the course of the decades, and now what you know, what is the nugget that you can give them?
Oh, that's a question I love. Well, if you're young or maybe not so young and happen to be starting out in music, just be dedicated, tell the truth, and if you're that dedicated and you don't feel like you have anything else you can or want to do with your life, have no plan B. Plan A. I only had a plan A, and look where I am. And I don't say that with ego. It's like anything can happen when you're dedicated. Sometimes it doesn't happen exactly how you want it to happen, but a version of that life will happen that will be satisfactory to you. So go out.
As long as you're doing what you love.
Do what you love. Tell the truth. In these days, because it's hard to get record deals and stuff, go out there, slug it out, you know, make a video in your garage. And, you know, even if you make a $100 video in your garage, if the song is good and the atmosphere is there and you have some kind of charisma, and you're telling a good story, keep telling those stories. Sell some good merch. Sell your CDs or whatever you're selling these days, stickers and buttons and stuff on the road, and just get out there. And every performance should be great because you don't know who's going to be in the audience, who could help you out. You should just always play like it's the last day on earth.
To that point, and this is a good reason, this is why I want you to listen to Enter Shikari. The reason that I fell in love with them initially was because I saw them, they were playing, this is the band from London, they were playing at the Rock and Derby Festival, mm-hmm. which was a one-off festival, basically. They were on the last night, they were on the same time as Megadeth. And I had interviewed the lead singer earlier in the day, and I was like, oh, I feel so bad for them, because they're like, I mean, nobody's going to be there. And so they were playing in this, like, 4-H barn, and there were maybe 30 kids. It was a dusty floor. Mm-hmm. It was just this barn, hideous setting. And I go in, my husband went over to watch Megadeth, and I see Rao, the lead singer, and he's on the side of the stage, and all of a sudden, you know, jumps on stage, and they start going, and I had never seen anything like this before, and I've been to a zillion shows.
Mm-hmm, I bet.
They were so electric. They were so fantastic. I texted my husband. I was like, get over here now. So he gets over. He never went back to Megadeth. They were so unbelievable, and that was the thing. They're like 30 kids out here, but it was the best show I've ever seen.
Well, they played like their life depended on it.
And now I am their biggest salesperson here.
That's incredible. But, you know, just one last maybe funny story.
Yeah.
You know, I haven't wanted to dedicate myself to a band in a very long time. So my cousin Julie calls me up and she says, you know, my neighbor's son is in a band. Like, if I haven't heard that story for 25 years,
yes.
I don't, you know, like, okay. So she's not really good. You know what? What are you sending me? I'm sending you a CD. Okay. She sends me the CD. I listen to it. It blows my mind. It's a band from South Florida. They're called Ether. They are heavy. They are filled with doom and gloom. My favorite. So I made a promise to them that I would solicit their record to 10 record companies. And I did. All independents. Mm-hmm. Some of these current lazy A&R people... what they look at these days are these, I guess you call it analytics, that your numbers are not good. Oh, you mean Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram?
Jesus, yeah.
Well, you know what? It's your job as a record company to get those numbers up, to get those this band out there. But you know what? If that's your stance, I'm not here to tell you any different. And I got that from a few labels. But one person who's dedicated as an A&R person, his name is Mike Gitter. He works over at Century Media. He signed Ether.
Oh, wow.
So we just got a record deal.
Oh, my God. That's amazing.
It is amazing. But Mike also has another band that he signed. I have nothing to do with them, called Three Teeth.
Three Teeth.
Fabulous. Like
that. What kind of music is that? Doom?
Heavy. Well, I only heard little clips. Guys, don't hate me if I don't have it correct, but I would say like heavy industrial.
Okay.
Heavy industrial.
All right, good. So
which
Ether
I love.
And Three Teeth.
Ether.
So everybody listening to this, check them out.
Ether, yes, on Century Media, coming out next year.
My husband loves that kind of music.
Oh,
and
good.
That's his thing. So
well, Ether have a record out right now called There's Nothing Left For Me Here. I will give you a CD to
Where are
to
they
him.
From? South Florida?
South Florida.
What part?
Around Lauderdale.
I'm from Miami, then I love them already.
Yeah.
And the Three Teeth, I mean, I basically have three teeth left, so...
You do not. You have a beautiful smile and incredible teeth.
I love you, Michael Alago.
Oh, I love you,
Congratulations
Juliet.
On all your success.
Oh, well,
and
thank
I'm excited
you so
to
much.
See, we will be going to lunch at some point.
Absolutely.
And I've got a million friends.
This
to
year.
Away. Yes.
Okay, good.
All right. Love you, buddy.
I love you, too.
Michael is one of the most important figures in music history. Really, I mean, if it weren't for him, honestly, who knows what would have happened with Metallica. I mean, I'm guessing they probably would have been okay, but maybe not so soon. I don't know. But he's unexpectedly so down to earth and so willing to meet new people, too. Fans, stuff like that. He's just really a wonderful guy with a huge personality. And you can find out lots more about him when he releases a new book for Backbeat Books. It should be released sometime in the fall of 2019, he tells me. Actually, he says the autumn, so he's much classier than me. Also, he'll be out in Coney Island on February 28th as part of Steve Blush Presents The Art of the Interview with Michael Alago. That's a Coney Island baby on Avenue A. And of course, if you haven't seen Who the F Is That Guy? The Fabulous Journey of Michael Alago, it's on Netflix. I love you, Michael. Thank you.